Javad Falaturi, the outstanding Muslim Shiite philosopher in Germany. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Revolution of 79.
That the Americans didn't learn about it
because there was an
the Shah's
that also talked to a number of people.
Mohammad Reza Shah had a tough time during the mid-1978. He was straining every nerve to keep his relations with the Carter administration. But the United States didn't seem to grasp the gravity of the situation in Iran.
I don't know enough about Jimmy Carter's mindset. Maybe Gary Zick does. I mean, I don't know if Jimmy Carter really said to himself, if we got rid of the Shah of Iran, everything would be terrific in Iran, because we'll bring about a democratic, libertarian, you know, secular government. Or whether Jimmy Carter didn't realize what he was saying, or thought that the Shah was so strong and powerful a character like Ferdinand Marcos, that this stuff would go over big in the United States, but it wouldn't matter to the Shah. The latter is my guess, is that Carter had no understanding of how weak the Shah was.
I was the person that was responsible for reporting to the President of the United States about what was going on. I wasn't the only person, but I was the principal. That was my job. And I wrote memos saying, you know, there are demonstrations, there are problems. We're seeing signs that things are not going well. It doesn't seem to be getting better. But I do remember vividly in August of 1978, which was quite a long ways into it, though the biggest demonstrations hadn't happened yet, Ambassador Sullivan was on vacation and came home, and I took him into the White House to see Mr. Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor. And I was in the room with Brzezinski and Sullivan, and Sullivan said to him, you know, Brzezinski asked him, what's going on in Iran, and you know, what's the situation? And he said, don't worry about it. The Shah has it all under control, and you have nothing to worry about.
Set against such a drop, the Shah appointed Ja'far Sharif Emomi as his prime minister. His close connection to the clergy had made him the successful candidate in a competition with more qualified rivals. The appointment was a desperate attempt to restore peace to the country. Winning the vote of confidence, Sharif Emomi told the parliament about his plan for national reconciliation. By September 1978, the Shah had changed his tune on public demonstrations. He called for martial law in the capital city of Tehran and other big cities. Demonstrations were proscribed, nighttime curfew was imposed, and arrest warrants were issued for opposition leaders. On September 8, 1978, the faint hope of reconciliation between the protest movement and the Shah's regime vanished when a great number of demonstrators were slaughtered near Jalle Square in Tehran. the day was called Black Friday.
Forget, he was pretty stupid during this period too. Instead of going to his cherished allies for 30 years and saying, look, I've got a problem, he was attempting to deal with them in his own land. In fact, the guy he picked as Deputy Inspector General of Imperial Guard had been a Khomeini guy for 5 years, you know, or maybe 3 years, but he went straight to Khomeini. That's why the rapprochement with the religious leaders that he tried for in the spring of 78 didn't work, because the guy that was running it from his shop was running to screw it up on Khomeini's benefit.
I believe that the secret of understanding the Shah is to understand that, in fact, the Shah was a very weak personality who had a very low sense of self-worth, of self-esteem. He was not a powerful character. And the result of that was that he was, partially for good reasons, partially for not so good reasons, eternally fearful of being overthrown. I mean, one has to remember that his father was overthrown by foreign powers. One has to remember that he was the subject of an assassination attempt in which bullets actually entered his body. So that would make one pretty fearful of future assassination attempts. That was in 1949. One has to remember that in 1953, the United States overthrew Mossadegh with the cooperation of the British. Not quite clear what the role of the CIA was, what the role of the British was, but all that to the aside, and brought the Shah back to power. So if we were able to get rid of Mossadegh, we could probably get rid of the Shah. And he was always concerned about the fact that, in fact, he was not sufficiently important to America that he would be guaranteed to be kept in power.
The country had passed the point of no return. In a span of 4 months, from October 1978 to January 1979, momentous events happened just to accelerate the downfall of the Shah. The period was marked by widespread opposition, massive strikes, and demonstrations through the whole country. During this period of time, the Shah's men left the country one by one, and soon the Shah found himself alone, in deep depression, and under the world's media spotlight. This time, the United States seemed to be a fair-weather friend of the Shah.
The Shah came to the United States for medical treatment in what had been, I guess, late 1979, early 1980, somewhere. Helms went to see him in the hospital in New York. And the first thing the Shah said to him was, "Why did you Americans turn against me?" So certainly by the time the revolution got underway, he had his doubts about us. And I think it affected his ability to manage the crisis.
Sharif Emomi began a policy of meeting the opposition's demands before being made. He did away with the unpopular Rastakhiz Party and announced all political parties in the country legal. Hundreds of political prisoners were released and freedom of expression became a civil right. The Prime Minister also curtailed SAMAC's powers and closed down casinos and nightclubs. The imperial calendar was also abolished. During the heyday of the Rastakhiz Party, Mohammad Reza Shah once said, "The party will include all people of Iran, except those who are rebellious." Politically inept, the Sharif Emomi administration was unable to appease the angry opposition. And as for the Americans, they hadn't reached a consensus on what attitude they had to take towards the revolution. The disagreement between Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, and Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State, was just a case in point.
Most Americans couldn't find Iran on a map if they tried. They have absolutely no idea what's going on in Europe in the last 300 years. Americans are very, very, very parochial. I mean, their greatest interest is who's winning the Super Bowl or the World Series right now, what's happening to their personal health insurance. They just don't have any real appreciation for foreign cultures of any kind. And it's not just the people. I mean, large numbers of people in the put into public office don't get it. You know, I had a colleague that went in to see George Bush reasonably after the election and spent 45 minutes of his hour with Bush trying to explain the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and came out tearing his hair. And this was a fellow that got elected president. There's just a very, very limited understanding of, foreign nations and cultures. We're a superpower by the fact that we're a super economic power and a super military power. We're not a superpower in terms of foreign understanding.
Problem was, you had a regime, an administration, I should say, the Carter administration, that had deeply divided counsel about countries like Iran.
What they did do is bring in a guy by the name of Stan Escudero, who was a later ambassador to, I think, Azerbaijan and one other country in the Caucasus after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And Escudero was a kind of a controversial figure in the sense that he had been an outspoken critic in the mid-70s of our support, essentially of putting all the American national security eggs in the Shah's basket.
The third problem was that the American embassy in Tehran was woefully ill-informed about what was going on the street.
And Escudero was critical of that. But it almost terminated his career because it ran counter to what then Secretary of State Kissinger was advocating, the U.S. policy and the Ford and tail end of the Nixon administration. But he was also a fluent Farsi speaker. And so when the revolution happened, Sullivan asked for Escudero, or somebody like Escudero comes in, to infiltrate the crowds, which he does, specifically to try to get a sense of what the ground truth is with the demonstrators. And Escudero ends up reporting back repeatedly with Sullivan on, he meets religious leaders, he meets student leaders, he gets a very good sense of the opposition to the Shah, reports back to Sullivan, and essentially convinced with Sullivan's views that the Shah's done. This is a widespread opposition movement. It goes across not only religious but all the stratas, from the bazaar to the Gulm and the religious movement, and even in elements within the military.
By autumn, popular support for the revolution was to the maximum. Those against the revolution preferred not to speak out. That's while some predicted that the victory would be achieved in November. On the 6th of November 1978, General Ghulam Reza Azhari succeeded Sharif Emami. A military government was the last hope.
A month later, General Azhari had a heart attack and he was in the hospital. And our ambassador Sullivan went to see him. While he was there, the general waved him over to his bedside and said, and he whispered in his ear, he said, "Yeah, the country is lost, for the king cannot make up his mind." And to me, I didn't hear about this until later, actually, but it is the single clearest description of the problem. The Shah had lots of assets at his command, lots of resources that he could use, and he couldn't make up his mind how to use them or to use them effectively.
On December 2nd, over 2 million people in Tehran took to the streets heading for Azadi Square. They called for the downfall of the Shah and the return of Imam Khomeini.
The time that almost everybody realized there was a problem, that maybe it had gone too far, was at the time of the Ashwa-Teshwa riots in early December. News came out that they were going to have a massive demonstration. They said they were going to have it. The army threatened to stop it, and things were getting bad. And when the demonstrations took place, 1,200,000 people in the streets, And I did most of the count. I was experienced at Berkeley, where I used to count the demonstrators for the local press. About 1,200,000, no violence. And everybody concluded the Shah was gone.
A few days later, on December 10th and 11th, reportedly around 9 million people throughout the country staged large demonstrations. Even discounting for exaggeration, these figures may represent the largest protest event in history.
The world radically changed in 1979. I mean, even independent of the Iranian Revolution, you had the start of an Islamic century. You had the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which ultimately showed that a small sort of religious power could, in fact, challenge militarily a superpower and win. So the whole way the world was being perceived changed, and one key piece of it was the Iranian Revolution. So sort of nobody knew how to deal with this. We didn't. The Russians didn't. So the world radically changed in this very critical year of 1979.
By mid-December, the Shah's position had deteriorated to a point that he wanted only to be allowed to stay in Iran. But he was turned down by the opposition. In late December, he agreed to leave the country temporarily, and still he was turned down. On January 16th, 1979, the Shah and his wife left Iran.
Do you expect the Shah to return to Iran? And if so...
I don't think this is up to him.
Well, he says he's taking an extended vacation, and obviously he's leaving you with a lot of problems to try to solve, and...
Well, there's a power to ruin the country, too.
In the end, it was the Shah who was responsible, in the sense that I think he came to believe that the greatest obstacle to his realizing his great ambitions for his people, the country of Iran also, were the Iranian people. And if it weren't for them, everything would be great. Well, it's pretty hard for a king to stay in power when he thinks his people are the obstacle to the realization of his dreams to make a great country.
Scenes of spontaneous joy followed, and within hours, almost every sign of the Pahlavi dynasty was erased. February 1st, 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran in a chartered Air France Boeing 747. The welcoming crowd of several million Iranians was so large that he was forced to take a helicopter after the car he was being transported in from the airport was overwhelmed by an enthusiastic crowd. Now, the undisputed leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, was greeted with cries of Khomeini, O Imam, we salute you, peace be upon you, and Islam, Islam, Khomeini, we will follow you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Imam Khomeini brought dignity to the Ummah. I'm going to mention some of the lessons that we get from this man. It's important for us to remember these blessings of Allah. And then finally to see, well, what was his legacy for us? And how do we slowly take steps to become like Imam Khomeini? So what did Imam Khomeini do for us? There are certain values, Islamic values, Islamic principles. What Imam Khomeini did was he made those values, he revived them. They were there before. I'm going to mention the ayat, I'll mention the hadith. They were there before. But then Imam Khomeini embodied them. He stood for them. What before was a discussion, what before was theory, what was before in the books, it's different when we saw it enacted. Once we saw it enacted, it was then easy to emulate. They have a saying that they say in Farsi, that once you fixed a puzzle, once you fixed it, something was a mystery, something was a puzzle, once it's complete, once it's over, then it's easy. The challenge is to bring it to life. And that's what Imam Khomeini did. I'm going to give some examples. For instance, Islam teaches us, Islam of Rasulullah, Islam teaches us that Islam is supreme. The supremacy of Islam. Not that we want a seat at the table. Not that our whole hope is to stop Islamophobia so that we can just be treated like human beings. No, Islam is supreme. Hadith. Al-Islamu ya'lu wa la yu'la alayhi. Islam is supreme to everything. And nothing is better than Islam. Islamic principle. Taught by Rasulullah. What happened? Some brothers and sisters, some of you are younger. You don't remember the days before Imam Khomeini. What did Imam Khomeini do? How did he change history? What were we like before? Why are we so close to the victory once we went back and embraced our Islamic principles? Remember, they had divided the world into two. They were the mustad'afin, the weaklings, those who would get bullied, those who would be trampled, those who would be taken advantage of. And then there were the first world, the true leaders. Some people, people like you and us, some people had accepted being third class from the third world, second class citizens. Used to having people talk down to them and being treated like animals. This had happened before Imam Khomeini. Things are different now. You and I will never go stand for that. But how did it start? I want to give you some examples. Because what we were doing was seeing the Imam do this, and then we saw our own strength. One example. This example, context is important. The imposed war is over. 200,000 shahada. Iran didn't apparently, it didn't end the way that they wanted. Right? And the end of the war, it didn't end the way that it wanted. It was World War III. And Iran had resisted for 8 years. Finally, for certain reasons, Imam determined that this is the responsibility. And he said that now we're going to have a peace treaty. Imam wrote a letter to the leader of then one of the kingmakers. There was the Soviet Union at that time. There were two main powers, one America, one the Soviet Union.
Imam wrote a letter to Gorbachev. And in that letter, he wrote him and he explained to him about changing his whole way of life and thinking. Imam Khomeini, right? From the other way, the third world, second-class citizens, and Imam Khomeini is giving him this elite advice, special advice. This is a video, you can see it. So what happened? So now, the Imam Khomeini is sitting there, and the representative of Gorbachev comes. And Imam Khomeini has written that important letter. Imam Khomeini is sitting there, important advice. Imam Khomeini is listening through an interpreter. And he sees that the man tries to give the normal formalities. They haven't taken the letter of Imam Khomeini seriously. Right there in the session, Imam Khomeini tells that man, he said, I tried to introduce you guys to the higher realities. He starts to scold him. He says, I knew you guys wouldn't get it. And then right there, Imam Khomeini gets up, you should see the video, you see the foreign minister. He just gets, he doesn't even shake the hand of the Taghut, he just walks out. Al-Islamu ya'lu, wa la yu'la alay. Islam is supreme, I'm advising you. When you see somebody like that, then they give strength, dignity, karama, standing for the truth. Kufr to the Taghut is a fundamental, these ayat of the Quran, a fundamental principle in Islam. But we needed to see it enacted. What does God say in the Quran? We all have this ayat memorized. فَمَنْ يَكْفُرْ بِالْتَاغُوتِ The person who does kufr to the taghut, وَيُؤْمِنْ بِاللَّهِ And believes in Allah. فَقَدْ اسْتَمْسَكَ بِالْعُرْوَةِ الْوُثْقَى This person is holding fast to the firmest handle. We all heard before that Abu Abdullah taught us kufr to the taghut. He taught us. He said this. وَمِثْلِ لَا يُبَايِعُ مِثْلَهُ Someone like Hussein will never make bay'ah to someone like Yazid. Never. Strength of Islam. Imam Khomeini. Again, I want to tell you a story. This is from the beginning. The life of Imam Khomeini needs to be studied. From the beginning. The revolution needs to be studied. The 15 years he was in exile need to be studied. How difficult it was. The dark times. That needs to be studied. It gives hope, brothers and sisters. Now, Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini at this time, this is in the beginning of the revolution. The Shah had his commandos storm a school, a hawza, Faydhiya, next to the shrine of Hazrat Ma'asuma. He had them storm that school. They attacked the unarmed hawza students. They were flinging them off the roof. It was complete destruction. Commandos! A few days later, Imam Khomeini gave a fiery speech. You see, the head of the SAVAK, and some of you have heard from me a little bit about the SAVAK, the intelligence organization that was the muscle behind the Shah, and how savage they were to the brothers and sisters, the mu'minin and mu'minat. What did they do to them? At that time, the head of the SAVAK was a monster named Colonel Molevi. He was the person who personally had the commandos go in there and do all that destruction, throwing those people off the rooftops. Imam Khomeini, when he gave his fiery speech, he mentioned Molevi, the colonel. But he didn't want to mention his name, as if he was too najis to even mention his name. He said, I won't even mention the name of that person. He said, unless I give the order for them to cut his ears off. Cut his ears off, not literally cut his ears off. In Iran, when they're going to teach you a good lesson, Imam Khomeini with no power, this is the beginning of the revolution. They're being crushed. They're throwing them off the rooftops. This is the beginning. Strength. Kufr to the Taghut. Imam Khomeini sitting there in front of the students, he said, no, I won't mention that man's name unless I give the command for them to cut his ears off.
2 days later, the Savak come and they arrest Imam Khomeini. They take Imam Khomeini into solitary confinement. So Imam Khomeini now solitary in confinement. And now that they're completely in control, the same monster who led the attack, Colonel Molavi, he comes to the prison cell. Imam Khomeini, solitary, no help, no support. So he thinks now Imam Khomeini is broken. He comes to Imam Khomeini, he said, "Agha, have you given the command to cut anybody's ears recently?" Imam Khomeini looked him up, looked dead into his eyes. He said, "It's still not too late for me to give the command." Imam Khomeini was his bravery, brothers and sisters, some of us, we weren't a lot, legendary. Legendary, this man. The focus of Imam Khomeini, brothers and sisters, was on building human pillars.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyim محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Dear ladies, welcome to another episode of your own program. This is Muslim Lady. You are hearing us from IRIB English Radio. I am very much happy to be here at your service. This is Asma. And once more, I have the pleasure to be with Sister Zainab to help us with today's topic. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you so much, sister.
Thank you for being here. It's been quite a very fruitful series of sessions that we're having together. We're learning a lot from the queen of all the ladies, Lady Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha, how she treated her parents. And then after she grows up and then she comes to the age of marriage, how she treated her husband. And we actually went through some specific detail of the relationship between couples according to her life, how she's been modest, she's been not demanding so much of materialistic things from her husband, knowing that her husband is not capable of affording all those, you know, materialistic needs and whatever. And also, considering Allah in every step of her life, even in her relationship with her husband, and being the daughter of the Prophet, still she's doing all the chores of home and she's not sad with that. She's supporting her husband and she's being this mental support that we're just talking about in this modern life. And then, do we still have some more about her relationship with her husband?
A very small portion is remaining, that what kind of favor she had with her husband. We said almost everything that was must to be to take as a model from her life, to have that attitude towards our husbands. But now we have something very, very strange that she has been thinking of. Towards the end of her life, you know, she makes a list of wills and expresses her wills towards her husband. You know, you never know when it's your time and you're going.
Yeah.
Always have that list and always share it with your husband that, you know, I have not prayed these many salats. I have not kept these many fasts. Please take care of this after me. Who is actually going to look after you? Have that, you know, a connection with your husband and always discuss that with your husband. Now we have something very strange. Lady Zahra Salaamu is thinking over here. She's thinking, she's so caring, she's so loving. She's thinking of her husband after her.
Yeah, the solitude of her husband after her.
She's thinking of her children after her, you know. In one of her reveals, she tells Imam Ali al-Islam that after me do marry... She mentions the name, one of her relatives, her name is Umame, and then tells him that I think she is more concerned towards my children and she's as good as me for my children.
Oh so my God, marry her. That's very difficult.
Marry her after me. But just imagine today if we even joke.
That's impossible.
If we joke with our husbands, we say to them that if I die and you got married with someone else, don't even dare to come to my grave.
Yeah, I would be alive just seeing you and then I will shut you.
Or I'll come as a, you know, I don't know, a devil and irritate you.
I'll come back as a ghost and then kill you with my own hands.
That's selfish. That's selfish. When you're gone, you're thinking about yourself. But she has always been thinking about the other person.
Still, you need to be so much evolved to
but
say
you know,
such
not,
things.
Not just for his desires or something.
I know what you mean, yeah.
She has been thinking of her kids. The very important point when she tells him, get married after me, is that she tells him, a mama is like me for my children. Her attitude towards my children is exactly like that of me. So I am concerned about my children. See her worldview, see her nature, see her thinking, the broad way of her, you know, thinking. Now she has other lists. She tells him like, do come to my grave, do recite Quran and do other things. And then she says one of the beautiful things that I don't think any women will dare to say this to her husband.
So let's put it just as a cliffhanger and then we'll be back after the break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So this is Muslim Lady. You're listening to our today's discussion, which is all about the lifestyle of Lady Fatima Zahra. Actually, we've been through it for quite some sessions and some long sessions, of course, which we are learning too much from it. Just as I interrupted you before we go for the break, you were about to say something. You said that she told her husband something that no woman would dare to say.
Exactly. So when she was in her last days of life, she... tears are rolling down her cheeks and she says to Imam Ali al-Islam that my dear cousin, she always addresses him even in this very tough time when she's ill, when she's sick on the deathbed, and she's addressing even there with some sort of great respect, and tears are rolling down her eyes, and Imam Ali asks her for the reason and she says to him that I never lied to you.
I never cheated you.
Yeah.
I never went against you. And, you know, Imam Lili Sam gets so much pushed with her words and says, oh, Fatima, what are these words that you're saying? Your status is much, much higher than this. You have been the best in taqwa. You know, you have always carried out whatever is obligatory. You have always avoided whatever was supposed to get, you know, whatever we have been commanded not to do. And you have always been the best of the followers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You have been so fearful towards Allah. And you really don't know how hard it is for me to lose you at this point of time. But, you know, death is something that every soul has to
taste. How devoted he is to his wife, actually.
Both of them, see? Yeah, see the conversation?
It's a mutual relationship.
The conversations show, reflect so much respect, so much love, so much concern. The problem that is in today's couples is that we are self-centered.
Exactly. Yeah, I do believe
thinking
so
about
as well.
Self. We are least concerned about we are in a relationship. We are in a mutual relationship. But, you know, trust is lacking. Everything is lacking. I tell the Muslim ladies out there, do you really dare to tell your husband, I never lied to you, I never cheated you, I never went against you?
Oh,
you know,
wow.
They have been somewhere.
Well, that's a nice question.
Seriously. You know, ask this question to yourself. And change your attitude
and then measure
accordingly.
Your love.
Exactly. You know, actually, even if there's something wrong, Allah is all forgiving. But now change your attitude.
Exactly.
Now try not to lie. Now try not to, you know, keep secrets. And now try not to go against. Because sometimes your husband is saying something and you try to tell him, oh, I don't care whatever you say. I just want to do whatever I like.
Yeah.
Never go against him. Because the permission of husband is something given more importance in Islam. Indeed, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all-wise, all-knowing, and whatever he commands has a great philosophy behind it.
Exactly, yeah. Thank you, dear ladies, for staying with us. This is Muslim Lady. We're still talking about the behavior of the queen of all the ladies with her husband and how she treated him so devotedly, so with so much of passion and love and commitment. And she always respected him. I guess this part is finished, the way she treated her husband. And now we come to talk about how she treated her children.
Definitely, yes. So, we have seen how her behavior has been with her husband. And when children come, many women have this, or many men actually come and complain, say that, now since we have kids, my wife has forgotten me.
Yeah, that's very natural.
I will tell you in a couple of discussions how beautifully she has managed, because in one of the episodes you asked me the question how she managed to balance. I don't think we had enough time to explain, but now
yeah.
I think,
because that's the most difficult part.
Exactly, because now I think I'll be able to explain this one. Well, children are something. If there's a couple, if it has to get 5 stars added, it's children who add that charm,
yeah.
The stars to the family, who complete a family, actually.
The tree of love is actually going to have much more of roots when the children come in.
Exactly. That's how you can put it beautifully, because a literary person is standing in front of me, and that was a beautiful way you can put it. So she had 4 children. She had 2 sons and 2 daughters, and towards the end of her life, she was pregnant with a 5th one. However, that's a different story, how she had a miscarriage and all. But, you know, when it comes to kids, we have a pretext always. We have this excuse. I have 1 kid. How can I manage my husband, my home, my job, my father, everything?
Yeah.
with just one kid. I'm saying in terms of children, she had a good number of children. In terms of her husband, he was in the worst of the times, in the wars, in the wounded situation.
Seriously, that's very difficult, you know? Even the grandmothers, when they talk about their life, since they had more of children, a greater number of children, when they talk about their relationship with their children and also with their husband, you just feel shocked and so surprised because...
How they managed to balance.
Exactly. Because right now, when you see the families, they are just three. I mean, the couples plus one tiny little one, and then they cannot manage at all.
The more they are less, the more they are, you know, disturbed.
Exactly.
Actually scattered, and there's no balance.
How come?
Because they don't, our role model is not Lady Fatima Zahra Sallallahu Alaihi. Now see her way of life. What has been her main focus in the upbringing of her children was spirituality. We said that she was a direct student of Prophet, peace be upon him. She learned each and everything. She had very focused on these verses from Surah Taha, which says that teach your family the prayers, the salat. Also have in Surah Tahrim, all those who have, all the believers, protect your families from the fire. And, you know, she had a very deep understanding of these verses and deep look. So her major part was the spirituality. Now the very important question I'll answer in a very short, where she would definitely give sadaqah, should give her alms for her children, should give her charity, should do everything Prophet commanded. And, you know, we are saying how she balanced. She's playing with Imam Hassan alayhi salam. But at the same time, she's respecting Imam Ali. She would recite poems which would say, oh Hassan, be like your father.
That's very beautiful.
Be like your father and hold the rope of truth very firm.
So even in her nursery rhymes, she's just teaching her children to be like their father.
Because we have this excuse, I am managing children. How can I, you know, take care of my husband?
I guess it's all related to priorities. You know, a woman has
How you balance
things. Then again,
we were confused how she balanced. Now she's saying, oh, Hassan, be like your father. You know, she's not talking to Imam Ali, but she's expressing all love to him.
Exactly.
And at the same time, she's playing with her son.
Yeah. And speaking to the ladies of this time, I would say that it's true the balance is very much needed, but the balance does not come without prioritizing your important issues.
And without using your intellect.
Exactly, yeah. That's the whole point.
You have so much of it. You use it at so many wasteful things. Please use that in the right place.
Try to have a plan for every single step of your life. And I guess everything is going to go on track. Everything is going to be balanced then. So this was all the time that we have for today. Muslim ladies, it was a pleasure for me to be here with you. Thank you, Sister Zainab. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and preserve you with His never-slipping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files. I grew up in the United States with a counting song that went like this. One little, two little, three little Indians, four little, five little, six little Indians, seven little, eight little, nine little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. Now this was supposed to be a song for kids to learn how to count. And the other part of it is they dive in the boat and the boat turns over. 10 little, 9 little, 8 little Indian boys and continues. If one thinks about what is being said, it is shocking. But as a kid, I just mimicked the lyrics like the other kids. not realizing the overall effect. I also grew up being shown Indian savages on Westerns and how the poor white man just wanted to live in peace and develop the land that he had discovered. But the Redskins would not let them live in peace. This is the other process, meaning dehumanizing people, and these are just two examples of the way the original inhabitants of North America, the natives, were demonized and discounted, even up to this day, in what is now the United States. From the time the European colonizers stepped foot on that land, the white man saw the natives as less than themselves. They were less human, less smart, less civilized, less deserving, which led to the invaders being able to forcibly remove and exterminate much of the original population of the land a lot easier. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. Today we will be looking at the original inhabitants of North America, the natives. I am Marzia Hashimi. Welcome. Well, the natives had lived on that land for tens of thousands of years. In 1492, when Columbus actually landed there, there were 112 million indigenous people. 112 million indigenous people. Keep that number in mind, because as we fast forward and we go to 1650, we have gone from that number of 112 million to 6 million people. Imagine that, by 1650. Unfortunately, the tragedy is so multifaceted. We look at then from between 1776 to 1887, and 1.5 billion acres of native land was stolen. This is the story, only part of the tragedy of the natives. Well, from being free to roam and live on over a billion acres to being forced to live on reservations, this became the reality for most natives who didn't die at the hands of the colonizers. Reservations were set up by the whites to control the native population, while at the same time more of their land could be stolen. Harsh measures were implemented, and brainwashing and miseducation were techniques used, as well as the Christianization of the natives on the reservations. Now, the land that the Europeans forced the natives to live on usually was not as fertile as the land they were used to having, or was the type of terrain that they were not familiar with. And many different tribes were thrown together on a reservation, not giving thought to if they were friendly with each other or if the tribe was used to farming or not. We're going to look at the role reservations have played and continue to play in the oppression and attempted elimination of native people with my first guest.
Bleak.
Oppression.
Small.
They're beautiful and sad at the same time. It's beautiful because you're surrounded by people that are just like you. But it's sad because everything that affects big cities, whether it's drugs or alcohol or everything's magnified on a reservation. You see it up front, like in your face.
Sick? You know, there's alcoholism, there's, you know, there's abuse, there's a domestic violence. There's a lot of things that go on a reservation that really goes overlooked.
Just a compromise. It was an agreement based, well, forced agreement probably, that Native Americans were put kind of out of the way, out of sight.
Yeah. Prison. It's like where we're trapped.
What do you think is the most common misconception about reservations?
That there's some kind of abundance, that natives are happy, that they're caring for each other, that they live in some ancient way.
Ooh, sad.
Poor.
A concentration camp. Reservations were made to isolate Indian people in hope that we would die off.
Depressing.
Unfair. Because they're not as good as other lands. They're the land that the government and people don't want.
Trapped? It wasn't great farmland, it wasn't great homeland, and so it kind of feels like a place off to the side.
Even to this day, the natives are fighting for rights, to keep the little what they have.
There are no good reservations. Here's your reservation. You can't go across that boundary. This is your reservation. And I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and we're one of the few lucky people that got to remain where our homelands are. But there are other reservations where people were forced there, and they can't fend for themselves like they used to do in the old days. You can't hunt anymore, you can't fish anymore. Because you're just stuck on a reservation on these substandard housing, living in third world country conditions, youths killing themselves because there's no future, there's no hope. That's a reservation to me.
Very sad indeed, and one which hopefully makes us think of what Native Americans have gone through and what they're going through even right now at the hands of this white settler colonial entity. Well, let me get our first guest onto this program to give us a first-hand perspective of all of this.
Juan B. Mancius, the tribal chairman of the Carrizo Comecrudo tribe. Juan is the eldest born to a lineage of hereditary chiefs of the Carrizo Comecrudo, but also descends from the Tasuki Pueblo and Kikapo nations. He has held leadership roles as an assistant tribal administrator with the Kikapo Traditional Tribe of Texas and the tribal administrator of the Scotts Valley Band of Pama Indians of California and the Alabama Coushatta Tribe of Texas. Today, Juan focuses on decolonizing both tribal people and others. He has written a 12-step decolonization program and presents it frequently at conferences and seminars.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome to Hidden Files. Can you tell us about the role reservations played in oppressing the natives?
At the very beginning, I think a lot of the reservations that were set up were set to confine and to change our life ways to the lifestyles, and there's a difference between those life ways and those lifestyles. Our life ways are our traditional values and our traditional beliefs compared to the ideals of lifestyles that was brought here by the colonization. And that became very oppressive because we were practically being brainwashed to change, to accommodate, the colonizers that were here. And so for a long time, I think, I know that a lot of our relatives were on other reservations were not allowed to leave the reservation without permission. And that's become commonly most of the undoing of losing a lot of our language, losing a lot of who we are. Of course, you know, then by doing that, they stole a lot of the land.
Well, what are other techniques used by the Europeans, in your perspective, to oppress the natives?
I think that for the longest time, the big oppression in this area has been, you know, the Spanish mission concept of coming in and trying to, they were cutting our hands and cutting our legs and, you know, hanging us and to try to, so those that didn't want to convert. And that happened throughout the, you know, the Middle Americas, what is called Americas now. So there's a lot of oppression based on being forced to learn one language and to forget your language. The boarding school system was one of those. The missions of this area of